Please call the case.
Case number SCWC29649, Kanahele v. Maui County Council. Arguing for the petitioner, Lance D. Collins. Arguing for the respondent, Maui County Council and County of Maui, Mary Blaine Johnston. Also appearing for the respondent, Maui County Council and County of Maui, Patrick K. Wong. Arguing for the respondent, Hunua Ula Partners, LLC, Jonathan H. Steiner. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, Council. Are you all ready to proceed with argument today? Okay. I just wanted to note for the record that I had filed a notice yesterday regarding one of my law clerks having applied for a position at the McCorriston firm, and wanted to be sure that you'd all received that and that there were no objections based on that disclosure. Did anyone have any concerns?
No.
Okay, thank you very much. Then we will proceed to our argument. Mr. Collins, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so with 10 minutes to go, we'll have a yellow light come on to warn you that you're moving into that time. Ms. Johnston, you have 15 minutes, as does Mr. Steiner, and for each of you, we'll give you a five-minute warning as you near the end of the time, and then a red light will come on when your time is up. Okay? Please proceed.
Aloha and good morning.
Good morning.
Chief Justice and Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of Hawaii, my name is Lance Collins, and I represent the petitioners in this matter. May it please the court and aloha. This case involves the Maui County Council engaging in a series of marathon recess meetings of its land use committee and of the full council over a period of months with respect to the committee and weeks with respect to the council. And the circulation of 14 written memoranda authored by individual council members and circulated among the entire council. First, the Land Use Committee met on October 18th, 2007 to deliberate and make a decision with respect to the Wailea 670 development, which is now called the Honuaula development. That meeting was recessed and reconvened on October 22nd. The meeting of the 22nd was recessed and reconvened on the 23rd, recessed and reconvened on the 25th, recessed and reconvened on the 29th, and again on November 1st, 5th, 7th, 8th, 13th, 16th, 19th, and on the 20th. There was no notice, no additional notice pursuant to Chapter 92 for the meeting on the 22nd, the 23rd, the 25th, or the 29th of October, the 1st, 5th, 7th, 8th, 13th, 16th, 19th, and 20th of November. However, in between all of these recess meetings, the Land Use Committee did have other meetings that did not relate to the Wailea 670 bill. One meeting was held on October 31st about a bed and breakfast in Haiku, and another meeting on November 14th was held to discuss a bed and breakfast permit for in McKenna. At the end of the November 20th meeting, the Land Use Committee made final recommendations and proposed two bills for the council to adopt. The council met on those bills on February 8th, February 11th, and February 14th, but did not provide notice or the opportunity to provide oral testimony at the February 11th or 14th meeting. In addition, during the February 8th, 11th, and 14th meetings, 14 written memoranda were authored by individual council members and distributed to the entire council. Some were brief one-page memoranda, others were multiple pages with diagrams and maps advocating particular amendments to the...
Were those memos published anywhere for the public to see?
Well, in the record, the memos were filed with the county clerk the day before the meetings. That they were considered.
But not placed on a website or anything that people would be able to see them readily?
No, they were not placed on a website. And contrary to the council's practice where anytime anything written is considered by the council, even minutia, that it's all placed on the agenda. And of course, there was no agenda for the February 11th to 14th meeting, so it would not be possible to even place any of the memoranda.
So in terms of the proposed amendments, the public would have had to know that maybe they would have to go check with the clerk's office to see if something had been filed?
It's not clear because, it wasn't like it was filed a week before the meeting. It was, most of these were filed the day before or the day of these continued meetings. So you would theoretically have to be at the clerk's office when they're filed and hope that you saw them. But I guess, yes, theoretically, you might be able to ask the clerk, and the clerk would say, oh, yes, you just happened to come at the right time and just before we close, and these were filed. But at the meeting of February 11th, the public was aware of them because the council members talked about them and read from them and discussed them. And then on the 14th...
Was public testimony allowed on those proposed amendments?
No. And then on the 14th, the council then started moving to reconsider some or all of the actions that they took on the proposed written memoranda on the 11th. And of course, there's no way for the public to have known in the notice for February 8th that there were going to be all of these proposed amendments. And they certainly wouldn't have been able to have known that following the next reconvening of the recess meeting, that half of those would then be reconsidered and further modified.
Would there be a prohibition on, had the council simply presented the memos at the meeting, or the council members simply distributed them at the meeting? Would that have violated the Sunshine Act? What procedure should, in your view, should the council, to be compliant with the law, and presumably out of a desire to have some written record of what appear to be fairly complex amendments there for other council members to see or react to, what should they have done in your view and still be able to comply with the law?
Well, if I were the council chair or somebody that was advising the council chair on how to conduct the council meeting, when it became clear that there were going to be so many substantive amendments to these bills, I probably would have deferred action on the 8th and at the next council meeting put all of these memoranda on the agenda and allow the public the opportunity to look at them and talk about them.
So you would say there should be a multiple step process. So the first meeting should be open simply for the purpose of having these written memorandum put on the record. And again, your view would be they shouldn't be distributed before the meeting. Is that correct?
Well, they could be distributed before the meeting if there was time for the public to know that these were going to be considered by the council. Because I think, if they were distributed at the meeting and council members didn't have the opportunity to look at them before the meeting, that's pretty similar to council members simply orally stating what their amendment was. And I think during the depositions, the council members said the intent of these memoranda was that some of them were lengthy and technical arguments, and they essentially didn't either feel comfortable or didn't think it was appropriate to essentially state a 20-page technical planning amendment to these bills. But under the customary approach for meetings, there's nothing wrong with that. What becomes problematic is when communication between council members occurs outside of the meeting, and that's exactly what these written memoranda that were technically filed with some of them filed with the county clerk the day beforehand.
Now, the procedure that the CJ just mentioned is a possibility where the memorandum, say, would be circulated right at the beginning of the meeting. Would that also not create the potential problem that I think may have occurred here, where if you have justifications and lengthy explanations in a written document and everybody sits there and then reads it, what's going to happen is the public is kept out of the whole participant viewing process of being able to view the deliberations. In other words, everybody reads it, and in fact, following up, I think what happened on some of these reconsiderations, for example, see the first one on the bond, they passed around a written memo. All the council members looked at it probably, since it was sent to all of them, And then it came up for recon, and they just stated the motion, and there was no discussion of the substantive matters in it, and the recon was adopted right off the bat. They didn't get to anything substantive until the recon had already been passed. I mean, that's just the problem.
That's right, and that's why if I were the council chair or advising the council chair, I would have put these, I would have deferred the matter and put them on the agenda for the next meeting. Because, and with some of the more lengthier memoranda, that's precisely the problem, and that's in the opening brief, we went into the problem with the reconsideration and why the Office of Information Practices has encouraged boards and commissions not to engage in motions for reconsideration generally at meetings. Also, in line with that, the Land Use Committee meetings, in addition to the fact that the plain language of the statute says that a meeting can only be recessed to a reasonable date and time, and the conference committee report in 1985 clearly stated that the purpose of that was to allow meetings to be recessed to a reasonable date and time, was for this precise issue. There's no way with this record that anybody in the public could have known on October 11th when the agenda was filed for the Land Use Committee meeting about most of the stuff that the Land Use Committee eventually ended up considering or deliberating on because it didn't exist. We noted a couple of examples. One was Judge Mossman was asked as the OHA trustee to make comments about a variety of things that aren't self-evident from anything that was available on October 18th, and it took him and I guess the OHA staff a couple of weeks. And then at the end of that, he produced a letter and they talked about it and they changed the bills. But there's no way on October 11th or 18th that anybody would have even thought that that was an issue because it didn't come up till halfway through this marathon recess meetings and reconvening of meetings.
Excuse me one moment. Mr. Collins, if you could speak up just a bit so sure. Everyone can hear you. And I'd ask the clerk to be sure that our amplifier is up. It's not to the point where people can hear in the audience. Thank you.
Mr. Collins, is a per se violation of the Sunshine Law enough to set aside the decision by the county council, or should there be a need to show prejudice?
Well, I think that the test for voidability really is fact specific, and it really it's not an issue of prejudice because when interested members of the public prosecute a Sunshine Law violation, they're doing it as a private attorney general, and so the prejudice is to the public interest and of having open meetings, and so it's really a fact intensive process where the trial court has to really weigh and determine whether this was sort of a fluke and nobody intended it to be this way and it just sort of happened out of oversight or something like this, or it's something that was calculated and intended to completely avoid the Sunshine case, or it was somewhere in between, and that, I guess, in the first instance would be the trial court weighing that. But even if a meeting is not voided, a judgment for technical violations of the Sunshine Act should be in favor of the people prosecuting the violations, in part because that's the point of the Sunshine Law is to give guidance to public bodies. So even if it wasn't willful or egregious secret meetings, a judgment in favor of plaintiffs in these kinds of cases provide guidance to all public bodies about what the appropriate conduct is. So even if a meeting is not voided, the plaintiffs should be the prevailing party.
If this court were to rule in your client's favor, in terms of the Sunshine Law, what remedy is it that you're seeking?
Well, in the trial court, we asked that the final action be voided. Alternatively, a declaration that violations occurred because of the recesses and because of the circulation of the memoranda is also a sufficient remedy, because then the county council knows going forward that that is a violation of the Sunshine Act, and so if they do it another time, then it becomes something that's a question of whether it's willful.
There's a large difference between those two alternatives. Were those the only two alternatives you advocated?
Asking for essentially a voiding
the final action or declaration for everyone's information.
Well, the purpose of prosecuting a Sunshine Act case is that.
Were those the only two alternatives you advocated?
Yes.
And what would you get out of a declaration aside from the fact that technically you won?
Well, it would give guidance to the public bodies about what they can and cannot do. Generally, you know, for the most part, boards and commissions do try their best to follow the Sunshine Law, and occasionally they don't. Those are very rare exceptions, but then there's this huge gray area in between where it comes down to people are trying to follow an interpretation of the Sunshine Law.
So is it clear that none of the memoranda were posted or a notice of the memoranda were given to the public?
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
Not on any agenda or any notice?
That's
after the first reading, no notice was given, but there was a second reading, correct?
Yes.
So was any infirmity or any defect cured by the time of the second reading?
No, in part because the Charter of the County of Maui requires there to be two readings, and the second reading is the bill in its final form. And so, if you have to have two readings and one of the readings is defective, you only have one reading. And the second reading, it's not intended to be a remedy for any procedural problems with the first reading.
I guess my question was, and it may be in the record, whether or not some notice of these memoranda were given to the public or was given to the public between the first reading and the second reading.
Well, it was on Akaku and, then, of course, in the newspapers, because by the time the second reading had happened, this lawsuit had been filed. There wasn't any separate notice. The council didn't send the letter out.
Wasn't the last meeting noticed and there was testimony taken? The second reading meeting?
Yes.
Okay, so written notice and testimony taken.
Yes.
What's your response to Judge Ganoza's conclusion that the statute allows the voiding of final actions, and that in this case the final action was at second reading, which itself was compliant with the statute, and therefore there's no action or no remedy that needed to be given. What's your reaction to her analysis?
Well, if the bills as they were adopted as quasi-judicial acts, then for certain, whatever happened at the final reading would be it. But because there are legislative acts that require two separate readings in order to become law, it's the final action is the process of the bill becoming law, and it's both of those readings. If there's only one reading, the second reading is not a final act, because the first reading is part, as an element of making the bill law.
Would Judge Ganoza's position allow the Sunshine Law to be violated throughout the entire process, and then at the very end you could have one proceeding that was complied and that everything would be okay?
No, and that is why we've challenged the Land Use Committee. Each of these steps where the council takes some action in a legislative framework is a final action. If it were a quasi-judicial forum and there were procedural safeguards and that sort of thing, Judge Ginoza's reading of what a final action is reasonable. But when we're talking about a border commission that's engaging in legislative activities, what is a final action in a legislative setting is much more broad than what a final action in a judicial or quasi-judicial.
Section 11 says that it's voidable or void, I guess, the violations. So which one have you opted for? Is it void or is it voidable?
In Section 11?
I'm just saying, your request for a declaration doesn't render the action void.
That's right. It would be up to the trial court or this court.
Up to the trial court. Well, what's your position then? The two alternatives, it's voidable or it's void?
Well, the reason why it's voidable is because if nobody prosecutes an action within 90 days, then the final action is legal. So the language is voidable because if somebody files suit in those 90 days, then at the election of the trial court, they get to determine whether or not, now it's a May, and they removed the willful in 2005. So now if the trial court determines in its discretion that the context calls for voiding of the action, the trial court can do that. But it's not something that's automatic. Because after the 90-day period, it's a legislative acquiescence or waiver.
Mr. Collins, with regard to the notice issue, what is the plaintiff's position as to what the Land Use Committee should have done when it was unable to complete its deliberations on the day of the first noticed hearing? Is it your position that it could continue it one time without further notice, but if it was unable to complete its business in that one additional meeting, it then needed to re-notice and reopen testimony?
Yes. There are all sorts of things that come before county councils, and some of them are pretty, some of them are very short and don't have a lot of controversy, and some things are not very short and have a lot of controversy, and this is one of them. There were 40 conditions that the Land Use Committee had to rule on. Some of them were highly extensive and required further fact-finding. And so one way that the committee could have dealt with this issue was parceling it out so that some of the conditions were dealt with at different meetings instead of doing it all as one. And that way, they wouldn't run afoul of the Sunshine Law and also not be under this fear that public testimony was somehow going to
undermine. I'm just really curious. Why is the Land Use Commission, the Maui LUC, is not, you didn't name them as a party to this case?
No, because they're a committee of the Maui County Council.
It's a committee of the Maui County Council. Okay, thank you. And the other question I have is, you actually filed this lawsuit on March 5th, 2008, seeking just to void the actions taken at the November 20th, 2007 and February 14th, 2008 meetings. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So the February 14th, 2008 meeting was the actual final action?
That was the first reading.
The first reading?
The first reading.
Okay. So did you file an amended complaint?
No.
So the actual, what was the final meeting? The March 19th, 2008, correct?
That's correct.
So your complaint preceded that, and you actually sought to void actions before that final meeting.
That's
correct?
Right. The first reading and the report of the Land Use Committee transmitting the bills to them.
And the preliminary injunction was granted, but then there was a trial, and the trial dealt with those two meetings only. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, and the written memorandum, but yes, yeah, it just dealt with the series of committee meetings and the series of the meetings for the first reading.
So what action was taken on February, the two meetings that you challenged? Again, it was the first reading that you challenged?
And the meetings of the Land Use Committee, which transmitted proposed bills to the council with all of the conditions.
Okay, thank you.
At this time, we would like to yield and reserve the balance of our time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Collins. Ms. Johnston.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Justice Recklinghall, Justices Pollack, Koba, Tapiani. Thank you very much for the opportunity to address this issue.
And you should try to speak into the mic if you can. I'm sorry, again.
Sorry.
No problem.
First of all, I want to put a perspective on the situation with what was going on with this project. There were numerous meetings, 12 meetings of the County Council and the Land Use Committee, and its Land Use Committee, prior to, or I guess nine prior to the meeting that's first complained of, the Land Use Committee meeting in October of 2007. The finding of fact and conclusions of law that was entered by the Circuit Court at 109 cites to all those. So there's been intense testimony on this project starting in 2002. Two of those days of public testimony were held in Kihei, some of them into the night so that the people living there could come and give testimony. The findings of fact and conclusions of law entered by the Circuit Court and undisputed by the appellants was that the plaintiff, Kanahele, testified at four different of the meetings, that Plaintiff Bloom testified at two of different of the meetings, that Plaintiff Buchanan testified at four different meetings, that Plaintiff Conniff testified at five different meetings, and Plaintiff Moss testified at two different meetings. So for these individuals who have brought this claim, they've had many opportunities to comment on what went on.
Ms. Johnston.
Yes.
Shouldn't the public have had notice of these conditions or reconsiderations that the council undertook to make to the
they ordinance? They did have notice, Your Honor. The I know that Judge Ginoza has pointed out that concerns about what happened as far as the notice provisions. The proposed amendments all were filed with either the clerk of the court or with the with the Office of Council Services. They were available to the members of the public to pick up and read. Now, mind you, when the people got these, once the Land Use Committee and then subsequently the council as a whole went into deliberative process, they were unable to go and comment on that anyway because they are forbidden from taking part in the deliberative process.
Are memorandums of that nature legal? Are memorandums of that nature that have justifications and explanations and ask people to vote, are those things okay under our statute?
Yes, they're part of the deliberative process. The complaint is, these are the kinds of things that could have been brought up by the council members in their deliberations and would have been brought up. And the purpose of having them put them in writing ahead of time is to, one, give the other council members a chance to look at them, consider them, to expedite the deliberative process.
So you think these are permitted interactions?
I'm sorry.
You think these are permitted interactions of board members? In other words, our statute allows memorandums with justifications to be circulated and amongst all the council members, not in an open forum. That's okay. That's authorized by our statute for permitted interactions.
Okay. Well, the Circuit Court found on trial, and there's no objection raised by the plaintiff's appellants in this, that there was no discussion outside of the council meetings by any of the council members. They were strictly one-way communications. HRS 92 prohibits, allows two council members to talk to each other about council business. That is a permitted communication. It doesn't allow a whole group of council members to get together and talk, and that's the right to know case, which is the only legal authority that Mr. Collins has cited, which
isn't the procedure that was followed. Doesn't that violate 92.2.5, which says that two or more members, but less than the members that would constitute a quorum, present, discuss, or negotiate any position. Is that correct?
Is a communication that's permitted between two council members.
So when you circulate a memorandum to everyone on the council, okay, then you have exceeded the quorum, I take it.
You have, but the finding of the circuit court was that there had been no communication about that.
That finding would seem to me to be clearly erroneous, or leave us at least with a firm belief that a mistake was made. Because isn't the circulation of these very detailed memos setting forth the rationale and the recommended changes to the ordinance, in effect, presenting, discussing, or negotiating a position with the rest of the board?
There is no evidence that those memorandum were ever used by council members, that they were one way, they were not discussed until they got to...
Well, I don't want to go through the, read through the memos. They seem to be taking a position and saying, this is a position I'm advocating, and I'd like you to consider it. And they all end with saying, I would appreciate your favorable consideration of my proposal, which seems to me to be seeking a vote in favor of the proposal.
Well, again, the circuit court found that it was not, and that was not challenged by the plaintiffs below.
I see.
My understanding is that is the way that it's like saying sincerely yours, that while it says I would appreciate a favorable consideration, that was not really soliciting. It's just that I'm giving this to you, and I thank you for considering it, but not saying I want you to vote, I want you to come to support me on this. This is what I'm going to do. Please, and this is what
I'm going to recommend reconsideration. This is how I'm going to recommend the amendment be.
Right.
And so I would appreciate your favorable consideration of my proposal. Would you agree that a reasonable reading of the context of that statement, or the context in which that statement is made, would indicate that the person is seeking a vote, a favorable vote? Or
not necessarily.
Well, let me say, the statute says no commitment to vote is made or sought.
Okay.
Would you think that this is seeking a commitment on a vote?
No. In this case, no, because this is a standard on just about every communication, but if members had communications, wasn't taken, I want you to vote for this. And in fact, of course, it changed their positions.
What is favorable consideration? I don't want to quibble, but what does favorable consideration mean to you?
Well, I don't know that it's relevant what it means to me, but to me it would mean just please read this, and you know, I'm going to talk about it later in the deliberative phase.
Does the fact that it's a standard procedure, does that make it any better?
I'm sorry?
The fact that it's a standard procedure when memorandums are circulated, that votes are requested, does that make it any more palatable under the statute? But let me ask you something different. Would this there seems to be a lot of focus that this was, since it was one way, would it be any different if the author of the memorandums invited all the council members into the room and said, this is what I'm going to do. Here's the motion. Here's all my reasons. Here's all my justification. I would like you all to vote for it, but I can't talk to you now about it. And then the person leaves the room.
Well, I think that the Sunshine Statute precludes that when it says, while you may have two members, you can't, that's it. But it does provide for two members to do that, but not have a whole room full of them.
Doesn't it also say they didn't want electronic communications to bypass the intent of this statute?
Well, if the electronic communications are between the council members and they're seeking a commitment to vote, then there, you may have a violation. But that's not what happened in this case. This is what I'm going to do.
How were the memoranda distributed?
Okay, that's a good point that I wanted to address, because it comes up in Judge Canoza's decision. These memorandum were filed with the clerk. I'm not sure how they were distributed to the specific council members. I think they have folders or trays or something. Without comment, they were given to them. And Judge Canoza said there's no evidence that the memorandum were disseminated to the public or made available to the public. And I want to point out that there is evidence in the record that the public did have access to these memos. Mr. Connor, who was one of the plaintiffs, in a declaration that was attached originally to the motion for preliminary injunction, acknowledges that, says, this is in the record beginning at 34. On February 8th, 2008, the Maui County Council had a meeting. On February 11th, the council held a meeting on the matters approved in on November 20th. He says exhibits E and F, which are some of these, a couple of these memos, I was able to retain, able to obtain that were referred to during the meeting. Paragraph 11, further of the minutes he was able to obtain and look at. So the public, they were public documents.
When did he say when he was able to obtain?
Well, you have to go to another comment. This is, I can see why Judge Pinoza missed it, because pretty much.
Let me just ask you this. If they were not filed with the clerk's office, would this be a different case? They just circulated internally. They weren't filed with the clerk's office. Different case or same case?
Possibly. I don't know if I'd be making the same arguments, but they were filed with the clerk's office, and
I'm trying to understand if that's dispositive from your point of view. Why is it that the memos are okay from your point of view? They're not meetings. They're permitted interactions. They were filed from the with the clerk's office. What's the bottom line from the county's point of view?
Well, the county's point of view is that they were just documents available to the public.
Because they were made available to the public.
They were because they were made available to the public. And let me just to finish up. In the answers to interrogatories that are part of the file by Mr. Conniff, in response to where did you get these documents and when did you get these documents, he says, I don't remember the specifics of how I came into possession of the documents. They were either handed to me during the February council meetings or at a Save McKenna meeting around the time of the council meeting. So I think clearly establishes these were available to the, you know, to the public and in a timely fashion.
How would the public know that they were available there unless you're a sophisticated party?
Because each agenda that's posted has said you can go to the you can go to the council's office and see what the documents are. It's printed right on the agendas.
So the agenda says that documents related to this upcoming hearing are available in the county clerk's office.
I can't remember the exact language, but something to that effect.
But there was no new agenda for these continued meetings.
Well, for the agendas for the October 2007 meeting started on October, I guess, 18th. Each time the meeting was continued, it was posted on the agenda, which is posted in the clerk's office. It has that same language in it. So yes, that same language is for each of those sessions. And also, the agenda for the February meeting says you can look at these, and with the unless you find that the recessing was not appropriate, that carried over. It's still the same meeting, so you still have the same instruction on the.
Let's talk agenda. About the carrying over. Is that in this case? Why is not multiple carrying over of the meetings a barrier to the public in being able to understand or when a meeting that's of interest to them is going to take place? In other words, if you're not there at the first meeting, doesn't this procedure seem to require the public to go to meeting after meeting after meeting just to know when the next meeting is going to be? And if so, is that compliant with the Act?
The presumption is that the first meeting, when the first meeting is set, and it's continued, it's just a continuation of that meeting, and that is an action that is appropriate. And was it done in this case? It was a procedure that was filed, and I wanted to point this out, pursuant to the advice of the Office of Information Practices, and I will point you to declaration in the record that's attached to the Defendant Maui County Council and County of Maui's reply memorandum in support of Defendant Maui's counsel and County of Maui's motion for summary judgment. It's the record at 2269 by David Rotz, who was is referring to a meeting that happened in 2004. He was at the time counsel for the with council services advising the county council. He's since been made the head of that in January. He was made the head of it. He specifically, in connection with the earlier meeting, had asked OIP, is this okay, we do it this way, and continue to notice. And the response is, to
And your time, yeah, so your time has expired, but yeah, let's find out where it is in the record.
Where is that in the record?
Okay. That's, the motion starts at 2269 in the record, and the declaration's attached to that.
And where's the OIP opinion?
It's not an opinion, it's an email with the Office of OIP. It's exhibit, one. And this is Susan Kern, staff attorney for OIP, says, Dear David, I discussed the draft of the notice concerning the March 8th meeting. We think it suffices to reconvene the meeting so long as the date, time, and place of the continued meeting are also announced at the time the meeting is adjourned, subject to the announced continuation. And so that was acting on the advice of, the county was acting on the advice of the OIP both back then and followed the same process in the meetings that are issued in this case.
Did you tell him it was going to be 12 meetings?
I'm sorry?
Was he, when he was asked, was he told that it was going to be 12 meetings?
Well, nobody would know how many meetings there'd be. You know, it's just like if the meeting is going to go longer, you know, more than once or twice, what's the procedure? And this is the procedure that was recommended and was followed in this case.
Was there ever a new agenda for any of the continued meetings?
There were two agendas for the meetings that issued, the October 2007 meeting and the February. And each of those meetings, the first one was continued 12 times following this advice. The February meeting was continued twice following this advice. And then for the final action, a new
so
agenda.
So there was never an agenda saying that we would be discussing proposed amendments?
I'm sorry?
There was never an agenda that said we will be discussing proposed amendments.
No, the agendas don't say that. It's been held by the case law that it's sufficient if you identify what the matter is. You don't have to go and get into the substance. And in this case, the matter was said Wailea 670 and so forth, and that's sufficient notice that you know anything that arises under that particular project, it's going to be the subject of discussion.
Are there any further questions for Ms. Johnston? Very well. Thank you very much. Then we'll hear from Mr. Steiner at this point.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Jonathan Steiner on behalf of Honu'ula Partners, LLC.
Good morning.
Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I want to address some of the questions that have been raised by the justices herein. And I want to start with the memorandum of the proposed amendments and something that Mr. Collins said that about the fact that the public didn't have an opportunity to comment on these different amendments to the conditions that were being discussed in the Wailea 670 first reading. And I think Judge Rechtenwald was asked, well, couldn't could they have orally read these amendments into the record and done it that way? And I think that's kind of the point here is that had they done that, we wouldn't be here today. There wouldn't be a problem. They could have come in during this meeting without putting anything new on the agenda and said, I propose that we make an amendment to what happened when it came out of council and that we change the condition in this bill. And here's what I propose and spent a lot of time reading through it and then deliberating on it. And that's allowed without the public having a further opportunity to comment on the proposed amendment. And there's a Hawaii Attorney General Office of Information Planning opinion letter that specifically addresses that. It's opinion letter number 01-06, and in that they said, and I'm going to quote, as part of a board's deliberation, its members may propose amendments to a proposed rule, a permit, or a course of action under consideration. If a member of the public seeks to testify about not just the agenda item itself, but also each amendment proposed or each motion made, then that person is essentially seeking participation in the deliberation as an ex officio board member. And there's a number of different...
Isn't the purpose of an open meeting requirement that the deliberation take place before the public? And if you circulate before the meeting a detailed statement of what your proposal is, ask for any questions, which I assume falls in the category of trying to elicit a vote, and in effect seek a vote without saying the word vote, doesn't that mean that, you know, where you're falling in the same category as right to know?
I don't think so.
Where you have in effect serial meetings, but through letters.
The difference in the right to know cases, there are serial meetings where they went to them and said, can I get your commitment? And they did get their commitment on each of those. In this case, it was one-way informational memorandum saying, here's what I'm going to bring up at the meeting.
How can it be one-way if they solicit comments and questions?
The comments that were solicited, is to the extent they did, I'm not...
No, not to the extent they did. Should you have any questions, please contact me or the committee staff, and they mean people, and giving numbers. So they solicited responses, didn't they?
I hadn't really thought about the fact that it asked about contact.
So if there were questions,
in
that
didn't happen.
If there were questions, and that would involve deliberations as between those two people, and negotiation, I guess, or clarification, etc. Would that involve then obtaining some kind of commitment?
I think if there had been a callback and comments, then that
it's in the
possibly
record that
would have
there were no callbacks.
It's undisputed in the record that there was no evidence of any communication, and that was a finding of fact that was made by the circuit court that was undisputed. And the other thing is...
Yeah, how can you say there was no communication? There was... A letter was sent out...
There's a one-way...
Setting out the proposal and asking for favorable consideration. So there was communication, wasn't there?
That's communication. It's a one-way communication, and we submit that those one-way informational memorandum are allowable. And the deliberation over these amendments occurs at the meeting itself.
Allowable because they're not meetings, allowable because they're permitted interactions, or allowable because they're in the clerk's office for people to see?
Well, first of all...
Why are they allowable?
Very important that they be in the clerk's office available for people to their public documents, because... One of the most important things of the Sunshine Law is that government doesn't happen in secret, but it happens in the open. In this case, the public was able to view the process by reading these memorandum. And I want to make a very important point.
Does the Maui County Council have a website?
Yes, I believe they do.
I'm sorry to ask who this is.
And I don't know when these were posted on the website. That's not in the record. But what is, I think, very important, though, is that following the first reading, there was a second reading of this bill, and anything that happened with regard to these amendments that by that point were clearly part of the public record, the public then had the opportunity to come in and say, you know, there was an amendment proposed at reading number one, and they changed the bond condition from X to Y, and I really think that was a mistake because X was very important to me, Y is very bad for me, and I think that at the second reading, you should consider amending it. And then at that deliberation, the council could have taken that up, it would have received public comment, and that goes to...
Was there any changes between the first and second reading?
Not that I know of, no.
Okay. And when they considered these memos, for example, you mentioned the bond memo. What happened was, looking at Councilmember Molina's, the first thing he says, I'd like to make the members aware of the February 13, 2008 document to you and the members of the council. So he references the document. He reads the reconsideration motion. He doesn't have to say anything about his justification, any reasons or anything, and they just vote on it and it's approved, and that's it.
But they've got the time, the opportunity at that point to deliberate. If there is something that they want to deliberate in public, they can.
But deliberations and the reasons and all of this is supposed to be in the public. it isn't supposed to occur that all the council members have read everything and just and relied on something in writing and then voted on it, and nobody knows the reasons why the council has suddenly decided to reconsider something that they, in the prior meeting, they adopted.
If he had raised the same thing, not done the memorandum, read the memorandum into the record, and then they just voted for it, we'd be in the same situation.
Well, if he had done it that way and read the motion for reconsideration, everybody in the council would go, oh, what's your reasons why you're doing it? And he would have to explain his reasons and his justifications, and there would be deliberation, and it would be in the public.
I would respectfully submit that the same thing would have happened here. They read the memorandum. If he had read the memorandum, then into the record, then they would have, if they wanted to know reasons, if they weren't convinced by what was read into the record, then they could have asked for their reasons. The same thing could have happened here. If this was an issue that was at all controversial, they could have asked for the reasons and discussed it.
But the bottom line is not the result. The bottom line is the process. And the bottom line is it's supposed to be done in front of the public so the public can view the deliberation process. It's not supposed to be that everybody looks at this piece of paper and says, oh, okay, and votes aye.
Well, I would submit, we have submitted case law from other jurisdictions that do provide for these one-way informational memorandum that are acceptable. And
is it, again, I'll ask you the same question I asked Ms. Johnston. Would we have a different case if these memorandum were not filed in the clerk's office and available to the public?
Absolutely, we would, because that would be a communication that was not made available to the public. In this case, it was made available to the public. And that goes to, I think, I want to at least touch a little bit on the remedy in this case that was asked about from Mr. Collins, because the statute provides that if there is a violation, that the action, a final action, may be voidable. And I do understand the concern that was raised that, well, can you rely on it being a final action? And I think the important thing about that final action is it came up again at a final action, and there was an opportunity for the public to fully testify. And while that might, may or may not cure the previous violation, it does indicate that in this case, even though it may be voidable, that this court should find that these passing the statute was not void. In this case, the plaintiffs all had the opportunity, and there's testimony in the record cited before the court below and cited in our briefs before the ICA, that in fact, 3 out of 5 of the plaintiffs did testify at the second reading, and they were asked on deposition, well, did you have the opportunity to raise these concerns about these memoranda and these amendments that occurred at the first reading? And they
except
all said,
we don't know.
Yes, I had my chance.
Except we don't know if there was public notice through the agenda that other people who might be interested would have testified. Do we?
I'm sorry?
If these matters had been posted, these conditions that change the ordinance had been posted on the agenda, that might have invited or been of interest to other people who did not show up at these meetings.
I think by the time of the second meeting, these agenda items, the motion, and what was actually being considered at the second reading, if the amended act was actually posted on, you know, referenced in the agenda, they could have looked at that just like they would have if they had wanted to. They would have looked before the first reading and seen what's at issue here. So I believe that by then, the amendments to the conditions that are at issue, the ones that passed and the ones that didn't pass, had already been in the public record and are referenced by implication in the...
Would you agree that the idea of the amendments being made and their consideration and any deliberation should have taken place in a meeting by the council that was open to public view?
I would agree with that, and I believe that in this case...
And in this case, was it?
It was, yes.
Was it presented to the other members in public view?
What was the fact that there was going to be an amendment presented in the agenda, I think? Is that your question?
I'm just reading from 92.1. It says, opening up the governmental process to public scrutiny and participation is the only viable and reasonable method of protecting the public's interests. And I mean, I know you went through the formal process of filing this stuff with the clerk's office, but does that necessarily reach the general in public? The public in general?
I believe it does, because those people who are interested and are following this, the meetings were...
They would have to know that it was pending, though, in the upcoming meeting, wouldn't they?
This was all on TV. It was on Akaku, published all
of this. But we're not talking about what the media does. We're talking about the obligation of the government entity here to make sure these meetings are open. I mean, is it an open meeting where all this stuff is disseminated before the meeting, everybody has a chance to look at it, everyone knows what it's about, except the public isn't at that process. And when it comes before the public, the only thing that happens is a vote is taken.
There were deliberations at these meetings. It wasn't the only thing that happened. These meetings went, that's why the meetings were continued so many times. These meetings were continued a number of times because of the fact that there was intensive deliberations. It wasn't a matter of a rubber stamp vote when these things came through. And as it went through, they made amendments to certain conditions because they had to fine tune this. This was a very complicated, a very large project. And, you know, there are still further public meetings going on in this project, and there will be further ones.
Mr. Steiner, are you familiar with the procedures in the council meetings? Do they generally, or have they in the past, attached memoranda that were circulated? Have they attached those to the agenda?
I don't know the answer to that, I'm sorry.
You just know in this particular case they didn't. They filed it with the council.
Well, the memoranda came into being because they were amendments to something that was pending before them, they hadn't decided on, and they're allowed to do that. They're allowed to tweak what's before them. So the memorandum came into existence after the agenda was out. Therefore, I don't think.
How for the next meeting, though? The next meeting that they were being considered at?
The next meeting they were being considered, what was being considered was the amended bill.
Amendments,
so
right.
That would have been there.
The proposed amendments and that were in the memorandum.
The memorandum would have been in the public record for anybody to go and see.
But not attached to the agenda.
No, because
they were
those
filed with the county council.
They would not have been attached to the agenda because that wouldn't have been an issue in the next reading. It would have already been adopted into the changed bill.
Through this process.
I'm sorry. So they don't even vote on it? I thought you said they voted on the proposals in the memoranda at the next meeting.
What they did at the first meeting was a bill came to the council in this form. During the meeting, there were proposals that were made in the written memorandum to tweak a little bit.
During the meeting?
During the meeting, yes. And they're allowed to do that. You can change a bill. You can amend the bill during a meeting. Then by the time of the end of the first reading, they had amended the bill a little bit, some of the conditions in the bill. That passed. Then the amended bill goes to the next phase, the second reading. And the public has the opportunity to review the amended bill and determine whether it has any issues with the now tweaked conditions that are before the council on the second reading.
But I thought there was no opportunity for the public can see it but can't testify, correct?
That's not correct. And Mr. Collins, they did file their lawsuit between the first meeting and the next meeting, but there is an opportunity at the second reading for the public to testify, and in fact, 3 out of 5 of these plaintiffs did testify, and we asked them at deposition, this is in the record, although I can't tell you where, but it's in the record, we asked them, you know, did you raise any of these concerns about these changes? And they said, no. And did you have the opportunity? Yes, I did. And you testified everything, you had your chance to make your say, and they said that they did.
Mr. Steiner, HR 92.1 says, the discussions, deliberations, decisions, and action of governmental agencies shall be conducted as openly as possible. Did some of that process take place outside of the meetings in this case?
I don't believe so. I believe that the publicly disseminated memorandum, putting down...
Could have it been possible to present these memos in open meeting?
Yes, it certainly
would
be possible.
So it would be possible.
Yes.
and the statute requires that you conduct this process as openly as possible.
Yes. I submit if they had done that, we would have had an even further continued meeting.
It's inefficient, but it's open.
And I submit this is open, too, because of the fact that these memorandums are made public. And
so some of these deliberations must have taken place, even if you say people did not communicate with each other. You got that through depositions?
Well, there were no facts were ever put
So we don't know. We don't know then whether, as a matter of fact, the council members didn't contact each other or someone, some other council member, as a result of these memos.
Well, I think in a way we do know, because there were depositions taken of the council members.
And was that question asked?
Had the opportunity to ask them the question. It's his burden of proof to show.
Was the question asked?
I don't believe so, no.
And you didn't have any affidavits to submit or testimony to submit that said, I did not contact Mr. Molina. I did not contact any other council member after receiving these memos.
No.
Okay, again, so we cannot make that assumption then.
No, but you have to look at the procedural posture of the case. This was submitted as a stipulated set of facts.
When you receive
a contention that they did communicate.
When you receive a memo like this, would some of the deliberations, at least within your own mind, if you're a council member, and maybe even a decision, have taken place simply because of this communication, say, from Mr. Molina?
I think that certainly you read it, you go, okay, this is what he's going to propose. You think about it, and you think, okay, do I have a question about this? If I do, I'm going to raise it at the meeting, and we're going to discuss it. If it's a no-brainer, it's obvious, the bond should, for practical reasons, go from X to Y, then you just vote.
And you consider that as openly as possible, quote.
Certainly, as openly as possible, we could have everything. You could have endless meetings about these things, and then nothing would ever get done. There has to be a practical side to this at some point. And I think where these memorandum are placed in the public record, and they did get a chance at the next meeting to discuss anything that were in the memoranda, but that is reasonably within reasonable parameters as openly as possible.
Mr. Stenner, I'd like to ask you about the continuations of the meetings. Is there not, how is an ordinary member of the public who's not able to go and attend every meeting to find out when the next meeting is going to be supposed to be able to participate meaningfully under a system in which there could be apparently endless continuances?
Well, the way these meetings worked is they had they notice the meeting, and the first thing they do is they open it to the public for their testimony. And that's what happened in both these instances. The public was very involved in this, and they went all day or well into the night.
And then they went into deliberation, and then the meeting continued repeatedly.
Let's start deliberation, and they announced when the next meeting was going
to
be.
And if I'm a member of the public and I'm not able to go to that meeting, but I might want to go to the one after that, how am I supposed to find out, other than going and sitting in a room for the entire continued hearing, how am I supposed to find out when that next meeting is going to be?
There's a couple ways. One, through the press, the AKAKU. I believe, I'm not certain, but I believe you could contact the council and find out.
Not all members of the public have a TV or a computer.
That's true. But it already provides in the rule, it allows for a continuation of a meeting. So that's already contemplated. The only question is, can you continue it more than once?
Well, it says reasonable, and the way these were continued, they were continued to the morning, they were continued to the afternoon, they were continued to the evening, they were continued the next day. Sometimes there were three times a week. It was nilly-willy, and it was completely dependent on the member's schedule. It had nothing to do with availability of the public.
Well, the flip side of that, the problem is if you limit the amount that they can continue it, what you're going to do is you're going to encourage these boards not to deliberate as much. They're going to say, look, I can only have one extra meeting. They took all day with public testimony. I either got to vote yes or no after one day's deliberation at the continued meeting. And what you're going to do is you're going to get less careful, less detailed, and in fact, I would submit less open government.
Well, it's not one way or the other. I mean, one could reasonably notify the public.
How would I believe they were reasonably notified? It was announced at the meeting in public that there was going to be a continued meeting.
But you have to be there.
I think if you're interested, you can find out.
Why not post notice of the continued meeting in the same way you've posted the initial notice in the first place? Why not give equivalent notice?
Equivalent notice of that we're going to continue.
Professor Van Dyke said make every effort possible to notify. That was his recommendation. There was many ways that it could have been done.
I don't know, but I suspect if you had checked with the council, you could have found out that, yes, the next meeting is at this place. And the problem with posting it is you do that, there's statutory requirements. That becomes a new posting for a new meeting, new public testimony.
Statute doesn't say that. Statute doesn't say every time you post or any time you post a continued meeting that suddenly it's an agenda item and public hearing. The statute doesn't say that.
So you would suggest that the council should have posted something saying the continued meeting is going to be on X date?
Certainly that's one alternative that could have been pursued.
To be honest, I don't think there's anything in the record as to whether they did that or not. It is possible they did do that. I don't know if Mr. Collins knows whether that happened in this case.
Any further questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Steiner. Mr. Collins will hear your rebuttal. How much time does Mr. Collins have remaining?
7 minutes and 25 seconds.
Thank you. In the record at document 765449, this was the deposition of Council Member Michelle Anderson. The question was asked, do you ever recall Chair Molina stating during a council meeting or a committee meeting that he felt that enough public testimony had been accepted on the YYS 670 project? Anderson, yes, I recall that. Were you one of the council members who requested a public hearing in Kihei on the YYS 670 project? Answer, yes. And why did you do that? Answer, because I felt that we had had a lot of meetings that were recessed and a lot of information had come forward and that the public, and through that process, the public had become aware of what was happening with this project that they had not previously become aware of. In other words, when the project first came forward, very few people even knew the council was discussing it. And by the time we had several meetings over a period of months of which no public testimony had taken place, there had grown a groundswell of public interest, specifically in my district, and I felt that it was only fair to have a public meeting in my district so that members of the public would have an opportunity to speak about the project and the deliberations that had taken place since the start of the project, et cetera. Next question. Why did you choose the three-member public hearing procedure versus just having the chairperson of the committee hold? And then the question was cut off, and the answer is, because I asked the chair to do it, and he said he had heard enough and didn't want to hold a public hearing. And so that's the only option which is provided for in the charter, et cetera. So in this instance, as was stated by other counsel, these bills were very complicated. And at some point, the chair of the committee had felt like he had.
Can I just ask you, Mr. Collins, the time period of that was referring to the meetings that we're talking about here or earlier in the process? You said the meeting in Kihei.
Sure. So the question that was being asked is that in the county charter, there's a provision similar to the state constitution that allows council members.
But what time period Council Member Anderson
well, she
referring
was
to?
Threatening that during these recess meetings because she was upset that there was.
In 07 and 08. In 07 and 08.
In 07 okay. and 08, yeah. So this was during the committee recess meetings. She was very frustrated because there was all this new information that was being gathered. It wasn't just deliberating on the information they had at October 18th. They were receiving information. They were still doing fact-finding and actually getting all of the information during this entire series of recess meetings. So it's not like someone on October 18th could have gone to the clerk's office before the meeting and read everything that was going to be decided. Some of this stuff didn't exist, even to November.
And who was providing these additional facts at these meetings?
Well, we cited to the one, for example, the committee asked Judge Mossman about relating, I believe it was something had to do with parks and related to some of the Native Hawaiian issues. And that was asked not during the first recess meeting, but I believe it was the fourth recess meeting. And by the, I think it was the ninth recess meeting, he had written a letter as the OHA trustee and answered their questions. So there's no way on October 18th anybody could have even had known that the council would be deliberating on this issue, because the council didn't even know it was going to be deliberating on this issue until the fourth meeting, when somebody got the idea to write Judge Mossman. And so that's, you know, there's nothing open about that.
Mr. Collins, why, in response to Mr. Steiner's argument regarding filing in the public record a sufficient notice of the memos, why is that not sufficient notice of the memos?
Well, for example, several of the memoranda were written and filed on February 13th, but the agenda for that meeting was posted on February 13th, but the agenda was posted on February 8th. So somebody on February 8th, just before the council meeting, just thought, well, I'll go to the clerk's office and see what's in the record, goes down there, would not find half of these, most of the memoranda, because they were all written after the meeting that was noticed. They were written for these recessed and reconvened meetings that didn't even exist when the notice was posted.
But doesn't the notice, according to opposing counsel, it said the notice indicates that documents related to this matter are available at the clerk's office, the suggestion being that's enough to put people on notice that they could be there at any time, I guess would be the argument.
Well, that might be the case, except that it wasn't there even during the meeting of February 8th of the notice. I mean, some of the memoranda didn't even exist before after the recess meeting. I mean,
they deliberated on them on the February 8th meeting?
Did they deliberate them at the February 8th meeting?
Yes.
No. But that's the notice that was given, was for this thing. And, you know, the other point that I wanted to respond to, the issue of that it's the same thing to read a 20-page memorandum into the record, it's almost the same thing. But the difference has to do with time. And really, this whole case has to do with the restraints the Sunshine Law puts on our natural understanding of human beings and their relationship to time. So yes, you could read a 20-page memoranda into the record. You could read 10 of them into the record, but that takes a lot of time. And then you have this issue of having to recess and reconvene the meeting because the council has run out of time. And so it's not quite the same thing to read. In addition to the fact that if someone is listening to somebody's amendment being read into the record, or half an hour of colloquy about somebody's potential amendment, that will, you know, provoke people to ask questions, but itself as well, that, you know, these were large substantive amendments. And if there were these many amendments after having a a series of recess meetings where nobody in the public was allowed to know or participate, in my mind, it signifies that the council's rushing this. They've heard, you know, the council chair was saying, I've heard enough public testimony, I just want to run this thing through. And that goes against the spirit and the purpose.
What should they have done? In addition to putting the memos, is it your position that they have to read the memos in their entirety at the hearing? There's no alternative to reading them at the hearing? That would be my first question. And if the answer is no, what is the alternative that you think is consistent with the Act?
Well, you know, they could read it. They could have read each of these memos.
Certainly they could do it, as the law requires that. You're advocating
for?
No,
I think the best practice would have been to defer and hold a new meeting. I mean,
it would be to convene the meeting, to note that these memos exist, and then to defer the meeting, or to convene a meeting and have people sit there for, you know, however long it would take to read these memos and just read them to the public while they're sitting there.
Yeah, well, if, you know.
Which of those two?
Well, you know, either of those two, I think, would be consistent with the Sunshine Law, and it really would come down to what the presiding officer decided was appropriate. I just think from the record that we have, he wouldn't have forced the rest of the council to sit through reading 10 memoranda. So,
is the reference that council was referring to about being able to get it from, is, I'm looking at the February 8th agenda, and on the last page it says something like this, note, items listed on the agenda may be inspected at the office of the county clerk, 200 South High Street, Waikawa, prior to the meeting date. Photocopies may be ordered, subject to charges imposed by law, Maui County Code Section 264. Please contact the office of the county clerk to make arrangements for inspection or photocopying of a document. Is that what they're referring to?
In terms of it being available on the agenda?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the practice. I did my high school internship at the clerk's office. They're very reasonable and accommodating people that come and ask, but for these memoranda, some of them were filed minutes before the end of business, and the next recess meeting started first thing in the morning, so it's not like there would be an opportunity to contact the clerk's office and make arrangements.
Any further questions, Mr. Collins?
Thank you very much, Mr. Collins. And thank you to all our counsel today. The court will take this matter under advisement. Thank you.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 10188, County of Hawaii v. Unidev